You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, why don't we get going? First of all, good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to this forum on Internet governance. And for those of you who like to tweet, we've set up a Twitter hashtag at TechCTI. That's TechCTI, so you can feel free to tweet and make comments on the presentations today. The last few years have been interesting in the development of the Internet. On the one hand, we've seen tremendous growth in Internet communications and transactions. But on the other hand, we face risk of a balkanized Internet divided by national boundaries and geopolitical divisions. The latter, of course, is problematic because if various countries follow different principles, we lose the transparency and integration that has been vital to electronic communications. The worst-case scenario is that we end up with a Tower of Babel version of the Internet where different countries, different companies, different interests have different rules, and it becomes difficult to navigate across those various jurisdictions. To deal with these issues, officials at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development have undertaken extended discussion of the principles of Internet governance designed to promote innovation and economic growth. The idea is that if member nations, industry groups, and technical advisory groups could agree on fundamental principles, that this would aid communication and keep the Internet open and transparent. One of the leaders of this effort was the U.S. Ambassador and Permanent Representative to the OECD, Karen Kornbluh, and we are pleased that she is here with us today. As many of you know, she was sworn in as OECD Ambassador in 2009, and she has been a strong voice for economic growth and innovation. Prior to her appointment, she served as policy director for then-Senator Barack Obama from 2005 to 2008. And in 2008, she helped author Obama's policy platform for his successful presidential campaign. She founded the Work and Family Program at the New America Foundation and also has served as a Markle Technology Policy Fellow. She's going to discuss the principles of Internet governance. So please join me in welcoming Ambassador Kornbluh to the Brookings Institution.
Thank you so much. I just want to say that people who are interested in the Internet are a very attractive bunch of people. Just looking out. I want to thank Darrell so much for hosting this, and Jonathan Sallet for organizing it, and Kathy Brown is the brains behind this. Thank you so much. And then it's just such an honor to be speaking with Larry Strickling, who, as you know, speaks for the president on these issues, on the Internet issues, and it's been such a pleasure to work with him because he's just such a true leader, both in terms of an intellectual thought leader, but also in terms of the incredible team that he's assembled. And the Internet policy principles that we worked on were a real team effort across the whole government. It started out as something that Danny Weitzner and Phil Weiser, who was in the White House, and I started talking about. We talked about them with NTIA and Phil Revere's shop at the State Department, the Federal Communications Commission. So it was a real joint effort inspired by Larry's example. And I just want to say it's so appropriate that we're talking about this here at the Brookings Institution, because the Brookings Institution, as you probably know, going back to its founding in 1916, is really dedicated to the idea, the proposition that if you spread ideas, that leads to the increase of freedom and democratic values, and also to economic growth. And that's not always obviously a safe or an easy proposition. My kids have just come back to the U.S. from France, and they're studying history. And one of the things my older son is learning about is the impact of the printing press and what that did in terms of the development of so many of the things that we take for granted, whether it was the spread of first the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution and eventually democracies. Really, that so much of that wouldn't have been possible without the printing press that allowed individuals to get access to information. But I, as you also know from studying history, there were also a bunch of wars as those in power tried to put the genie back in the bottle, tried to stop individuals from getting their hands on information directly. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that a little bit of the dynamic is in play with the Internet as well, that the Internet is an amazing technology for getting information into the hands of individuals It's already had a huge impact in terms of jobs and economic growth. In fact, in the first 15 years of the Internet's growth, it's had more of a job impact than in the first 50 years of the Industrial Revolution. It's a prime job producer and growth producer in the developed world. It produces far more jobs than it displaces. It's also, as you know from the Arab Spring and all kinds of other examples, it's a tool for democratic aspirations, and that's why Secretary Clinton has talked about freedom to connect, an Internet freedom agenda, because of the importance of the Internet as a place where people can assemble, can learn, can express ideas. But obviously there's been a strong reaction, and there are countries like Iran that would like to put that genie back in the bottle, would like to wall off, for example, Iranian cyberspace from the rest of the world. And the difference in this situation, one of the differences between this situation and the printing press, is that the Internet's power lies in the fact that it's this global platform, that it's end-to-end communication across the globe. It's a single platform. And so if individual countries decide that it's in their interest to regulate their piece of it and to cut off people from their piece of it, you wind up, as Daryl said, with a lot of mini-internets, with a balkanized Internet, and you shoot the innovation potential, the job potential, the growth potential, and, of course, the democratic potential of the Internet. The key thing about the Internet's growth so far, and this is, I think, what Larry Strickling's going to be talking about, is that as it's developed, there hasn't been a need to get permission, no central authority to share ideas. Instead, there's been a decentralized system of public and private actors collaborating to ensure how it functions and how it expands. But this means, as I said, that if there's a heavy-handed approach that's taken to regulate it, it reduces the value for everyone. And so what the administration came to see is that you really need collective action to protect the Internet. And you really need to have a foreign policy that accounts for the Internet. That's become absolutely essential. And that's why the president issued the U.S. International Strategy for Cyberspace, which is an agenda for safeguarding the single Internet. And as I said, Secretary Clinton developed her groundbreaking Internet Freedom Agenda. These were really around the idea that we need to work together with other countries to protect this international global treasure. And it's also why the U.S. was supportive of the idea that the OECD had to have a high-level meeting in June to bring together a bunch of different stakeholders, to bring together the advisory groups that the OECD has on the technical community, the business community, civil society, labor, as well as the countries of the OECD and other countries that it could bring to the fore. So there were 40 countries actually represented there. And at the high-level meeting, there was a lot of debate, discussion, negotiation of these principles, high-level principles that are really not supposed to be a step-by-step prescription, but are supposed to guide our thinking about how you can both preserve openness, preserve the free flow of information, and at the same time protect some of these policy concerns that every nation has for protecting intellectual property, for protecting privacy, children, consumers, that you don't have to impinge on the openness of the Internet to address these kinds of things. And some of the exciting repercussions of the fact that these principles were adopted, and we'll be talking about more of the details of them, are twofold. One is that it said that this is what it means to be an open, democratic, developed country. You accept these principles. If you want to get on the growth train, if you want to get on the democratic train, this is what you should subscribe to, this kind of high-level principle that says you can use a multi-stakeholder process, be transparent, and still protect values. Now, the OECD in December took a further step, and it adopted these principles that's communicated that came out of the high-level meeting in June as a formal OECD recommendation. Many people in the room were actually there when this happened. It's pretty exciting. And what that means is that it's not only is it a further formal statement that these are really important to the countries of the OECD, but also that countries that want to join the OECD are going to be asked, how do you comply with these? What's your stand? And interestingly enough, the next country that's on the glide path to joining is Russia. So that'll be a very interesting conversation that we'll have, and we're all looking forward to that. So when, as I said, when Danny and Phil and Weiser and Larry Strickling and Phil Revere, Julius, others, and all their teams started to look at why we would use the OECD, a key reason was that it was in itself transparent, as much as an international organization can be, and involves these multi-stakeholder organizations, that it has these formal advisory groups. Plus, it played a key role in its in the history of the Internet. It adopted the e-commerce guidelines. It's the international e-commerce guidelines. It's got the international privacy guidelines. It does the broadband rankings. So this also led credibility to these principles. They're not coming out of left field from some organization that doesn't have anything to do with the Internet. This organization has played a role in the shaping of a consensus about how you approach the Internet. And then the second thing was, or the third thing I should say, is that it it is a place dedicated to economic growth. So it was a, another statement that not only is this kind of approach important for human rights, important for democracy, but it's also important for economic growth. And what are the three challenges that we were trying to address? Danny and I tried to lay this out afterwards in an op-ed. I'm not sure we were thinking this clearly at the beginning, but afterwards we knew why we'd done it. There are three kinds of problems that we were trying to solve. One was that there are some countries that would like to take the pre-internet world of telecom regulation and impose it on the internet. So they would like to take some of the rules that say that an individual government can control the rules of the internet and impose them, perhaps through an organization like the UN, on the internet, and that would lead to further balkanization. This is a statement that you don't need to go to another organization. Countries can come together, they can meet in a multi-stakeholder organization, they can devise some principles, and then they can go out and do it. So that was one challenge we were trying to address. Another is that, as I said, countries have the need to address certain public policy concerns that they have on the internet. These are very legitimate concerns, as we know, intellectual property, children, consumers, law enforcement concerns, and privacy, of course. And there's always some question, how do you strike that balance? How do you address these concerns? Do you have to restrict the free flow of information? And what these principles were a statement of was, no, you don't. And these allow democratic societies to say, this is how we go about addressing these issues. This is really different than what a country that wants to be more authoritarian about the internet is doing. This is dramatically different. And here's, we are doing this in a way that comports with openness, and let us show you how. Let's look at these principles. Let's tick off how we're complying with them as we go through our process. Dramatically different than, you know, in the dead of night, in, you know, in secret, restricting the internet to protect policy concerns. And I guess the other issue that I wanted to say is that we do have these what we called cyber autocracies. We have countries like in Iran and Assyria that and other countries that really would like to wall off the internet. And these what we want to do with these internet policy principles is use them as a consensus building device to work with other countries in the proposition to get consensus around the proposition that there's another way to go. And so there are countries that are fence sitters, if you will, between the countries that would really like to gain control, more democratic countries. And what we can use these principles for is to work with those fence sitters and say, here, let's go about it this way. So we're very excited about using them. I think one of the things we're going to talk about in the panel later is what do we do next? How do we take these principles, increase consensus, increase the knowledge about the importance of this, reach out to countries that are not as knowledgeable, that haven't been online, that are not rich countries, not part of the Rich Countries Club, which some people call the OECD, and explain how this is in your benefit, this is how you can grow, this is how the internet can work for you. I think many of these countries, it's scary. The internet unleashes all kinds of things that they're not familiar with. So one of the things we're looking at right now very actively, and we can have a discussion about this, is how do we find the next stage countries that we can sign on to this blueprint, work together with them, and build a foreign policy that really respects the values that we all hold dear. One of the things that Hillary Clinton said in her speeches on the Internet is that we want to ask other countries to join us in a bet on the open Internet. And we really feel that these principles and the actions that we're going to be taking with them, the consensus that we're going to be building, is doing just that, is asking other countries to join us in a bet on the open Internet. We have a number of countries, a number of stakeholders that have already joined us in this bet. We're extremely excited about it, very proud about it. And we really look forward to working with all of you, very attractive people, to continue to build the group of people that are making a bet on behalf of the open Internet. So thank you very much.
This audience is starting to sound like Lake Wobegon. All of you are clearly above average. So, we're also very pleased to have Larry Strickling with us today. As you know, he is Assistant Secretary for Communication and Information and Administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration in the U.S. Department of Commerce. In that position, he advises the President on broadband access and adoption. He also helped launch America's first public, searchable, nationwide map of consumer broadband availability. He has helped to craft a plan to double the amount of commercial spectrum that is available. He plays a key role in the Commerce Department's Internet Policy Task Force and the job of promoting the Internet domain name system through ICANN. So please join me in welcoming Assistant Secretary Strickling to Brookings.
Well, I want to thank Daryl and the Brookings Institution for hosting today's session and inviting me to participate. Now, Karen referred to you all as an attractive audience of people interested in the Internet. I look out at all of you and say, oh, these are the policy folks that couldn't score an invite to the Consumer Electronics Show this week. But actually, I would prefer to think of you as folks that want to have a serious policy discussion on these issues, and we all know that a serious policy discussion in Las Vegas is an oxymoron. So I'm glad you're all here today for today's discussion. Now, as you've just heard from Ambassador Kornbluh, the adoption of the OECD Internet policymaking principles last June and their subsequent transformation into an OECD recommendation was a major achievement in 2001. And I think we all owe a very large debt of gratitude to the ambassador for her leadership and commitment to this important effort, which was a key Obama administration priority for 2011. So please join me in just recognizing her again. These principles represent the strongest articulation of our vision for Internet governance. Through the OECD process, over 30 countries have now joined in that vision. And as we enter 2012, the OECD effort lays the foundation for furthering the global consensus on the multi-stakeholder model of addressing Internet policy issues. This is a critical initiative, as we will face challenges from a number of countries this year in many different fora. And the OECD policymaking principles will serve as our greatest asset as we face these challenges head on. In order to illustrate the work we have cut out for us, let me first emphasize that the Internet we enjoy today, this marvelous engine of economic growth and innovation, did not develop by happenstance. It emerged as the hard work of multi-stakeholder organizations such as the Internet Society, the Internet Engineering Task Force, the World Wide Web Consortium. These organizations all have played a major role in designing and operating the Internet we know today. And these processes have succeeded by their very nature of openness and inclusiveness. They are most capable of attacking issues with the speed and flexibility required in this rapidly changing Internet environment. Nonetheless, we face challenges to this model, even in our own country. And in that regard, I'd just like to take a minute to update everyone on where we are with respect to ICANN's program to expand top-level domains on the Internet. For the last 6 years, ICANN and its many stakeholders around the world have debated the rules for expanding the domain name system, essentially the Internet's address book, through the introduction of new generic top-level domain names. ICANN's process involved global stakeholders from the business community, civil society, registries, registrars, and, of course, governments. Nonetheless, in December, we saw parties that did not like the outcome of that multi-stakeholder process trying to bypass ICANN by seeking unilateral action by the U.S. government to overturn or delay the product of that six-year multi-stakeholder process that had engaged folks from all over the world. And I want to emphasize that it's really important here to separate the concerns that some industry members have from the process that they wish us to employ to change the decisions and compromises ICANN reached with the stakeholders. Based on meetings we've had with industry over the past few weeks, there's no question that there is a level of concern about the specifics of the program. We are aware that some members of industry believe that there may well be a number of unintended and unforeseen consequences that could jeopardize its success. Accordingly, I sent a letter last week to ICANN urging it to work to mitigate these concerns and issues related to the perceived need for defensive applications and to improve communication with stakeholders and potential new GTLD applicants prior to the launch of the program. Already, ICANN has taken steps to enhance its outreach in the United States, including an information session this morning here in Washington. And with broader awareness, it's possible that new top-level domains, in addition to facilitating the expansion of the Internet in local languages and offering a platform for entrepreneurs, could help in meeting some of the Internet's biggest challenges. For example, just last week in meeting with a number of content providers, we discussed the possibility that expansion of top-level domains could provide an interesting new vehicle for attacking the serious problem of piracy on the Internet. And that's something that we're going to be looking at very carefully over the next several months as applications come in, making sure that ICANN takes a look at what rules might be required of domain holders of things like .music or .movie that could, you know, directly confront the question of piracy on the Internet. Now, what I did not do in my letter was demand that ICANN abandon its multi-stakeholder processes to deal with these concerns. And I've been encouraged by ICANN's response to my letter today, in which they commit to review possible improvements to the program, specifically to deal with the perceived need for defensive registrations at the top level, as well as to complete their work on a series of work streams to facilitate more effective tools for law enforcement and consumer protection. But as is necessary in all multi-stakeholder processes, all of these efforts will require active engagement by all parties prior to adoption. And I urge everyone to get involved, particularly prospective new applicants, because if your application is successful, you're going to be operating a critical piece of the global Internet infrastructure. And with this comes responsibility to actively participate in ICANN and the other related multi-stakeholder processes, such as the Internet Governance Forum. But we cannot view this episode with ICANN in a vacuum. Each challenge to the multi-stakeholder model has implications for Internet governance throughout the world. When parties ask us to overturn the outcomes of these processes, no matter how well-intentioned the request, they are providing ammunition to other countries who would like to see governments take control of the net. As many of you are aware, this is precisely the challenge we face this December in Dubai at the World Conference on International Telecommunications. This conference, which is hosted by the International Telecommunication Union, attracts delegates from the ITU's 193 member countries. Specifically, this conference will renegotiate the international telecommunications regulations, a treaty drafted in 1988 that set the basic terms for interconnection of international telephone networks. Notably, the ITRs allowed for private agreements between non-governmental telecommunication carriers, and these private arrangements have subsequently become the most common form of agreement as most telecommunication providers privatized over the intervening years. Now, as former Ambassador David Gross recently wrote, some within the ITU and its member states would now like to see major changes to the treaty, particularly with respect to the Internet, as well as wireless, IP-based, and text generation networks, which have historically been mostly free of intrusive economic and other regulation. For example, some countries have submitted proposals to make ITU standards recommendations mandatory and thus enforceable by treaty, which would be a drastic departure from the current voluntary nature. Some countries have proposed moving oversight of critical internet resources into the ITU, including naming and numbering authority for multi-stakeholder institutions such as ICANN. Many governments have called for the ITU to play a greater role in regulating peering and termination charges in order to compensate for lost telecommunication fees. Also, in an effort to establish the ITU as an operational authority on international cybersecurity, some more authoritarian countries have proposed to include cybersecurity and cybercrime provisions into the ITRs. These proposals are relics of an industry structure that no longer exists. The ITU was established as the International Telegraph Union in 1865 to facilitate the interconnection of nationally administered telegraph networks. And as communications evolved, the ITU changed its name and scope in 1932 to once again facilitate interconnection of national networks, this time circuit-switched telephone networks run by national companies. For some, the next logical step is for the ITU to once again facilitate interconnection to today's network, the Internet. And while the technology has changed, the veneration that certain governments hold for central regulation has not. For some governments, the WICCAT conference represents an opportunity to shoehorn the Internet into a supranational regulatory body where it simply does not belong. These governments fail to acknowledge how fundamentally different the Internet is to the forms of communication which preceded it. The Internet does not operate under the anachronistic model of monopoly telephone providers that control all aspects of their networks within their countries. Rather, it is a diverse, multi-layered system that thrives only through the cooperation of many different parties. And all of these parties together form the network of networks that we call the Internet, and to disrupt even one could jeopardize the entire system. So our task is clear. We must continue to make the case that an Internet guided by the open and inclusive processes as articulated in the OECD policymaking principles will encourage the rapid economic growth and wealth creation that the Internet has made possible. It is incumbent upon us to convince other nations that enshrining the Internet in an international treaty will not accomplish these goals. The framework simply will not fit. An Internet constrained by an international treaty will stifle the innovators and entrepreneurs who have been and will continue to be responsible for its growth. As FCC Commissioner Rob McDowell said recently, upending the fundamentals of the multi-stakeholder model is likely to balkanize the Internet at best and suffocated at worst, and the states who seek to impose their control over the Internet will only be further removed from its awesome potential. At the Internet Governance Forum in Kenya in September, I made a call to action that I'll repeat today. All stakeholders should step up in support of the free and open Internet and the multi-stakeholder process that has led to its success. The multi-stakeholder process cannot work without you, and if we want to maintain a vibrant and growing Internet, we must all take action to ensure that the multi-stakeholder model continues to define the future of Internet governance. For our part at NTIA, over the coming months, we will continue to meet with all stakeholders to collectively develop ideas on how best to preserve the open and innovative Internet. In preparation for the December WICCAT, the U.S. government will stand up an active interagency process to leverage the expertise and talents of our various organizations to meet this year's pressing challenges. And key to that will be engaging with international governmental and non-governmental partners, and I encourage all of you to participate in these important discussions. Thank you very much.
Our last segment is going to be a panel discussion involving reactions to what we have heard and people expressing their own particular point of view, followed by an audience Q&A, so it'll give you a chance to express your views as well. We're delighted to welcome Danny Weissner back to Brookings. Danny, as you know, is the Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Internet Policy in the Executive Office of the President. As CTO, Deputy CTO, he works to promote the global free flow of Internet information, online privacy, and cybersecurity. He also works on Internet copyright protection, prior to this position, he was the Associate Administrator for Policy at NTIA. He also co-founded the Center for Democracy and Technology and the Decentralized Information Group at MIT. So Danny is going to moderate the panel of experts. I'd like to invite Danny to come up as well as the panelists. Danny will introduce them and guide the discussion.
Good afternoon, everyone. Daryl, thank you. Really appreciate having you all here. You've hosted a series of very important events discussing a range of technology policy issues, and we really appreciate the contribution that Brookings makes. The ambassador is right. You guys are just a wildly attractive audience. I'm distracted. is that what they do in France? Is that the way this works? Okay. It's great to be here. And of course, the panel is superlatively attractive. You guys all look like, you know, nothing compared to them. So we're here to talk about where we go from here with these internet policy-making principles. A lot of people in this room, a lot of people on the web contributed to the development of these principles. We now have them. They're written down on paper. They're in a couple of languages. They have all kinds of OECD seals of approval on them, thanks to the extraordinary diplomatic finesse and sweat of Ambassador Kornbluh. I think that as we start this panel, I just want to remind everyone of what it means in the internet environment to have a document like these internet policy principles and what we might do with them. As Larry Strickling said so wisely, you know, the model of multi-stakeholder policy development we really derive from the model of the creation and ongoing evolution of the internet itself. We derive this model, we derive this governance model by recognizing the fact that it took this kind of very broad-based, bottom-up, multi-stakeholder process to develop internet technology, to develop the administrative arrangements that keep the internet working in organizations such as ICANN, and that's just happens to be the way that we can all get together as individuals, as organizations, and keep the internet going in the direction that we want it to go. I would just make one observation, which is that I think we really have to keep in mind, more than anything else, that the internet is very much a work in progress, and we want it to remain that way. The kind of flexibility that I think lots of countries encouraged in the internet policy principles are really there so that the internet can continue to evolve both as a set of technologies and as a set of social business and policy practices. We're not here to answer once and for all what is the internet and what are all the right answers about all the policy questions. We're here to say, how do we keep this environment growing and developing so that it meets the kind of social needs that we have, the kind of economic needs that we have. We have this incredible panel, who are all well known to you. Bob Boorstin is the director of public policy at Google and comes with an extraordinary background in policy and politics, and has brought to the internet environment over the last decade really vital insight. I think it's probably fair to say that from the time that Bob started at Google till now, the world has really woken up for good and for bad to all the challenges and opportunities that the internet brings, and Bob's going to talk a little bit about that. Kathy Brown is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Corporate Affairs. Corporate responsibility. Thank you. At Verizon, and I think also brings the kind of perspective actually that Larry Strickling brings, this incredible transition that we are living through from a regulated telecommunications world to a global internet world, and finally Mark Cooper also comes from that kind of transition and has had to face the questions of how do we realize consumer interests in this new public policy environment that the internet has brought us. So I want to start with Bob, and just ask you, Bob, as as the world has opened up, has woken up to the internet, and particularly as governments have woken up to the internet, it seems fair to say that there are a pretty significant number of people around the world who really like the services that your company has to offer. You have a couple of users, but governments have also woken up and seem to have a variety of expectations about how you ought to be using the levers that you have over information on the internet towards one or another government purpose. How are you dealing with that challenge, and what are these internet policy principles say to you about how to approach those questions?
Well, there's a nice, easy question to answer in a minute or two. Let me start with just a couple of things. First of all, thank you, Danny. I think you look really sharp in that bow tie. So if we're going to go throwing around sartorial, we're going to do this sartorial comment thing here. Let's focus on that just for a moment. Thank you to Daryl and to Brookings for putting this on. A big thank you to Ambassador Cornblower, who I've met with in Paris about these issues in the past. You should see her office. If any of you want to become an ambassador, the OECD is a good place to be an ambassador. It also comes with a nice house, I understand. She has done an incredible job herding the cats that are the OECD members. And these principles did not appear out of space. They appeared from very, very hard work on her part. I want to thank Larry as well for his words today. I was very impressed by how short, how brief, I should say, all of the comments were coming from people who hold government office. As a former speechwriter for President Clinton, I know the value of brevity well. I want to start with just a comment on the irony of having this conversation here. And I think it's ironic because here we are talking about a set of principles that are meant to set out, that are meant to keep the internet open and growing and help the economy and innovation. While up on Capitol Hill, the big focus about the internet is on a piece of legislation that would take the U.S. from being the leader in the open internet and economic growth and internet freedom and cause us to slide way down the ladder. So I just want to point out that there's irony there, and we can talk later in question and answer if people want to about the impact that this legislation would have on what we believe is a really strong ecosystem that's developed around the internet over the past few years. Enough of my editorial commentary to go to Danny's question. While these governments get more difficult, and yes, they have become more difficult over the last few years, it's something like, and everybody has their own numbers, but it's something like four governments in 2002 that were in some way blocking or constricting the flow of information to more than 40 today. Companies like ours, companies all over the IT sectors, hardware companies, software companies, are forced every day to confront new situations. There is nothing precedented about what happens with the internet. And I think your initial comment about this is a work in progress is a really important thing to keep in mind. I think another important thing to keep in mind as we have this discussion today is that it's not only the bad guys that are doing these things. It's not only repressive regimes. It's easy to say Iran, Syria, China, Burma. Fine, we can all do that. But, you know, there were three Google executives found guilty of violating laws in Italy. Now, not everybody here might be familiar with the Italian justice system, but last I checked, it was fairly democratic. But nonetheless, they were found guilty because a video was posted up on Google Video. It was the forerunner to YouTube. We can get into a discussion of that. There was a law suggested in Australia last year that would have resulted in extraordinary censorship, all in the name of protecting children while on the internet. So please, don't think that this only applies to those countries that we like to segment out as repressive regimes or cyber autocracies or whatever term you choose. On the OECD principles, I would simply ask this question. When was the last time that representatives of more than 30 governments got together and decided they weren't the right people to take the lead? It's a big deal. This is a landmark moment. They said, oh, no, we don't want a government in charge. We don't want an international body in charge. What we want in charge is the same weird, decentralized group of parties that have brought the Internet to where it is today. That's a big deal. The OECD sets out a framework in its principles based on the concept, and I'm quoting here, that we should reinforce what it calls the open and accessible nature of the Internet. And I think those are absolutely critical terms to remember as we have this discussion, open and accessible. And I believe that these principles move us close, as Rebecca McKinnon's new book, which is out this month, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's called Consent of the Network. As her book puts it, it moves us close to understanding that we do not have to choose between anarchy in cyberspace and laws that will effectively ruin what we've built to date. That's a false choice. Anybody remember that phrase? Combined with other OECD guidelines on corporate social responsibility, some things that I would really point you to because the work the OECD has done in that area is extraordinary. These principles, at the very least, provide the balance that we should be seeking. They incorporate the best of other efforts to date. Whether you're talking about other international efforts, whether you're talking about the White House principles that the Obama administration put out, whether you're talking about principles that a group of companies, including Citi and GE and Google and others, put out under the National Foreign Trade Council about the free flow of information and economy. All of those kinds of principles, the OECD incorporates the ideas, incorporates them concisely and well, and God hopes those principles obviate the need for any new sets of principles. When we were in The Hague most recently in December when Secretary Clinton spoke about the subject of Internet freedom, I begged the people in the Dutch Foreign Ministry, please, no more new sets of principles. We have good ones. We all agree to them. Let's stick to them. And so I would beg this audience as well, please, stop talking about new sets. Take these. If you don't like them, make them better. But take these as a start. On the optimistic side, they provide for hope for a global framework for understanding and, more important, for action, concrete action, I think, on items like preventing certain institutions like the ITU, as Larry was saying, from grabbing hold of an area where they should have no control. And they help us move closer towards not making websites liable for what people post up onto them. This question of intermediary liability, horrible expression, not in English, sorry. It's what it's called in the trade. But essentially it says if someone posts something on your website, you might be responsible for the fact that it's there. That's an important issue. I also believe they could lead to strong economic action. Actions that will create jobs, and actions that will create trade agreements. This is very important to us. Trade agreements that reflect the new Internet economy. Trade agreements were essentially written before the Internet existed. They shouldn't be that way anymore. We got to change them. And we have in this set of principles I mentioned with the NFTC, National Foreign Trade Council, set out some ideas on the cross-border flow of information. Finally, what would help in the future from the OECD? What would help companies, governments, NGOs, all of the players? Clearly, better research. We need data in this area. No offense to Larry's Commerce Department. When you go to Commerce and you look for the data on what is the Internet's impact on the economy, it's pretty thin. We are doing those kinds of studies around the world, and you may have seen some of those, and if you're interested, I can guide you to them. The other thing that I think is extraordinarily important in keeping with the 50th anniversary of the OECD and what Karen also helped engineer is the concept of transparency. To do an advertisement for Google just for a moment, we've introduced our own transparency report, where you can go and you can see where Google services are not available because governments have cut them off or because we've made silly mechanical errors ourselves. But we hope that it's the kind of site that will serve as a model for others, and that as the OECD principles are put to use, transparency will emerge as an easy first step for people to take. So I will stop there, having gone on much too long, and I apologize.
Bob, thanks very much. We'll come back to you. Kathy Brown, you've been very involved in the development of these principles, and you've now started the drumbeat, not unlike what Bob said, that now we have to get on with it. So what's our task going forward from the perspective of a company that is responsible for a fair amount of the infrastructure of the Internet, really around the country and all around the world?
Thank you, Danny. Daryl, thanks for having this forum. I indeed had a little confab with Karen and Danny and others and said, you know, we really, having now struggled and done the work to put these things on paper, we really need to talk about them and get some meat on the bones and also get more dialogue on how they're going to actually work and what do we do with them going forward. And so I appreciate that Brookings took up that that challenge and that Karen is here to discuss this. I think everyone has said this is 34 countries who have signed on to this, but what was remarkable having gone through this process was that it was not just the government in the room. In fact, it wasn't the government in the room. It was the constituents of the government in the room, including civil society and the companies who are actually creating much of the infrastructure, the applications, the software, the innovating on this thing called the Internet, who were there together with representatives of governments, many of whom are in this room, and so I applaud you. There, it really was this this experience of government listening and also wanting, very interestingly, wanting this thing called the Internet to thrive, survive, and grow. And why? And it's because the OECD first was the right place for this to happen, but secondly had the right lens, and that is the lens of economic development. So when one sees this phenomena, the Internet, through that lens of economic development, the principles that you see here really do fall out. In other words, it didn't start with a lens of how need we regulate this thing that's creating wealth so that we can get a piece of it. Not to be cynical, but there's that going on in the world, right? Rather, it was how do we ensure that this Internet survive and thrive and grow so that economic development follows, not only for those developed countries, but for those who are emerging, the emerging technologies in the world, which is crucial, I think, to this next piece. Now, Larry Strickland, I want to say a word about our plain-spoken man from NTIA. He has been very direct and very clear about what the U.S. position is with respect to a sort of central regulation of this Internet. I was with him in Nairobi, and I have to say that it was a moment. It was a world moment when Larry said, look, we really can't go back. We can't go back. We need to go forward. And to go forward, we need to embrace these principles. We need to have a multi-stakeholder kind of ethic and approach. And that is the way we're going to achieve economic growth. He spoke to a convention of basically developing world folks who are all excited, by the way, excited about what this Internet can do for their economies, for their communities, for their people. And I think that is the challenge. He laid it out at that meeting, but we have it here in front of us. What Larry just described quite well, better than any of us could describe, is what this convention that nobody here in the United States even knows goes on. And that's what's a little bit, worrying, because I don't suspect you all knew that there was a world regulator who regulated the Internet. Now, I know that because forever and evermore, I was a regulator myself. I know all these folks. I've been in a business that has, you know, telephone lines, which no longer are that, that went through the period I call the Reed Hunt Revolution, when those things called settlement rates were really thrown up in the air, and we say we can't do this kind of economic regulation anymore. Well, there are some that would like to go back there. And I think this whole process is one where we get all frightened and worried that we would go backwards. I actually think that this year's process is a process to use to actually drive understanding of how the world is different. And that, with our friends and colleagues, frankly, our customers and our partners in emerging economies that we are in, Verizon is in, and also with governments around the world. So I would say to those folks, and I know there's a bunch of folks from the different embassies here, that our job is actually to be persuasive, prove our case to, by the way, a group of constituents who actually believe what we're saying. In other words, there is an understanding that this internet is both transforming the economic ability of folks who never had it before, of innovators in countries that are hungry for it, for folks, children across this world who want the connection with these networks so that they can take the world's information and see it. And when you're there and when you feel that energy, I'm actually optimistic that we can do a good job of persuading those, at least in the developing world, who think that the old way is the only way, that there's a different and new way. Now, what do I think in these principles are important for that? The reason the internet gets anywhere is because there's a network there to carry it. And the first thing we have to understand is that those networks are fundamentally different than they were in 1932. Larry did a very good job, I think, of just describing the difference. Now, Verizon, what is Verizon built? Verizon is built here in the U.S., as you well know, what the fastest, I think, fiber to the home network. We have some experience in this. But right now, we are rolling out the LTE network, the world's fastest right now, cutting-edge wireless network, where in your hand you have 20 megabits. Now, understand what that means for the developing world, to be able to use existing towers to put new technology in that would give you mobile access to fast internet, where countries before had no access except through a satellite, very slow. And we are connecting the world with our huge, huge pipes, right? Us and a number of other companies. That is the internet backbone. Okay, what has to happen? Well, all that information that's flowing across those networks has got to be free. The information, the data, has got to flow across borders freely. Otherwise, the little Google search that was done here cannot be accessed there. So it's got to flow freely. It can't be blocked. That's the easy case in our view because it seems so clear. But it also can't be economically blocked. It also can't be blocked because competitors can't get in. It can't be blocked because a country decides that you cannot have your server there, but you have to have it someplace else. And these are the issues that we've taken up and tried to grapple with in these principles. This thing called the cloud, they're really big data storages, right? And the beauty of it is efficiency. You can have it here so that you can access it there. And when I'm sitting with 20 megabits in my hand, 40 kilometers outside of Kampala, Uganda, I can actually reach a healthcare application that's sitting in Amsterdam. Are we going to allow that? Are we going to say that's okay? Are we going to be able to do that? And that's what this is about. It's not about just old regulations. It's about a whole different way of accessing information applications and actually life-transforming kinds of services and goods. So it is the economy. It's turning out this is the economy, right? So how are we going to have a global economy that actually is powerful on the ground locally? It's an amazing sort of phenomenon going on. For us as network providers, it also means that we don't go back to old kind of regulatory regimes that hem us in, that don't allow us to make the kind of investment that's enormously important for this to happen. It's all about investment. It's all about making sure the capital goes to where these things can happen. And I think why we were so involved and I think very satisfied with a very dynamic, robust process. By the way, there's a lot of words in here that we might quibble with, but directionally, we think this is the right way to go. So I think, Danny, I think this is all about direction.
Thanks, Kathy, very much. I'm going to come back and ask the two of you for your thoughts about how we'll know, perhaps a year from now, whether we're succeeding with this and what others who may be somewhere on the fence, whether they're stakeholders who are on the fence or countries that are on the fence, as the ambassador said, what will they be looking for signs of success or for progress that will persuade them that this is the right goal? Think about that question. In the meantime, a year ago, we were to look a year back, Mark Cooper sat here on this stage and said in a Clintonian moment, in fact, Bob, you would have been proud, said, the era of command and control regulation is over. And it might have been that Mike Nelson had the first tweet of that. Someone tweeted it. And I guess, Mark, I really would like to know what you mean by that and whether the principles that we're talking about here point to the direction of what we replace command and control with, and if so, how are we going to do that, and especially how are the constituencies in the interest that you've represented so strongly over the last many years, how are these interests going to be reflected in this new environment when you don't have command and control regulation to speak for consumers, when you don't have a traditional notice and comment rulemaking process into which people like you can file comments and get results and challenge in courts if they don't like the answers? How is this all going to work?
Well, let me start by saying, and I'm the only one who all day has said it, I speak for the Consumer Federation of America and no one else. I have participated in approximately 350 command and control regulatory proceedings. And anyone who tells you they work for the consumer interest hasn't seen them. They don't work all that well, and I think we need a new model. And the interesting thing is that when you think about the cases under which they would work well, they need a well-defined problem. And so when you put a railroad track in the ground or a wire on a pole that's going to last for 50 years, you tend to have a well-defined problem. In the digital age, we don't have well-defined problems. It's just too dynamic, too developmental, so that the people participating in those regulatory proceedings simply can never keep up. We need the people who live the space, the consumers and the industry who are there trying to move information, use it, to inform us about what's going to work. And that's why I talk about participatory regulation. But let me step back, and so now that's my pitch, and he kind of knew that was my pitch. But let me step back and talk about the year since, because there's been good news and bad news in the last year. And the good news is actually a little better than most of the speakers have told us, because the OECD principles on internet policy, the UNESCO Code of Ethics on the Information Society, and the Council of Europe Principles for Internet Governance, all of which were adopted in the last few months, embrace a fundamental set of principles and commitments. They share those issues as a consensus. And it's a lot more than 34 nations. It's 47 in Europe and 175 or some very big number in UNESCO. And let's talk about the three positive principles that they embrace. They clearly embrace the principle that an open, decentralized architecture is the pillar of the success of the Internet, unequivocal across all three documents. And you could throw in some older WSIS documents if you wanted, but I'm only looking at the last few months. Second of all, they are fully committed to an effective multi-stakeholder process as the only way to govern this dynamic activity. Unequivocal commitment to that. Third, and more interesting, is that they all recognize that the adolescence of the Internet and the digital revolution is over. It is time for the Internet to grow up and shoulder some social responsibilities, some public interest obligations. That's the good news. The bad news is that the list of social obligations, I call them maturation challenges, is extremely long. And now I'm going to read the list, because if I leave any off, I get lynched when I leave the room. So what are the challenges? Universal service, freedom of speech, empowerment of end users, preservation of non-discriminatory network management, protection of privacy and consumer rights, promotion of diversity, management of intellectual property rights, and maintenance of cybersecurity. And if I left your issue off, it's only because of the shortness of time. Those are the challenges.
As much time as you want.
What? those are the challenges that we have. We're only beginning to find formal ways to address those maturation challenges. And we have to do so in a very difficult context. We have to incorporate a vast array of new stakeholders and interests into the governance process without letting it bog down. It's been very flexible and dynamic, and it's also rough justice. You know, it's like open source, you know, rough consensus and running code. And it's worked for a long time. And the more people in the room, the harder it gets. Second of all, we have to accomplish the goals, those social and public interest goals, without destroying the fundamental openness of the process. So let me give you, and those are all wonderful high-level statements, and each of the documents I mentioned to you are wonderful high-level statements. Let me give you some practical mileposts. Of course, we have a compass. That's what these high-level principles are. We have to draw the map. And so here are some markers that I would put out on the road. And again, this is some lessons I've learned. First of all, we must not hold Internet governance hostage to the other challenges. I want to solve the intellectual property problem, but on a given day, if I can advance the Internet governance process, the core principle, I need to do that, even if I haven't quite solved my privacy concerns or my intellectual property concerns. So no holding the core of this machine hostage to my social obligations. They're really important, but the core is extremely important. Second of all, we need to avoid jumping the layers of the machine to solve our problems. I'm sure that I know lots of public interest folks who would like to reach down into the plumbing, into the technical layer, and solve their maturation problem. But I guarantee you, the week after you do that, someone else is going to reach into the plumbing and give you heartburn. They're going to reach down there and say, I need to do this, and that will break the Internet. So we need to solve our problems at the level at which they exist, rather than monkeying around with the technology. Third, we have to make multi-stakeholderism work. And here I will differ with the previous speakers. Yeah, it's worked okay, but we have not incorporated the vast array of stakeholders and their interests into the decision-making process to satisfy them and give it a sense of legitimacy. So the governance institutions have to work harder. And you've heard people mention the consensus around the OECD documents. Civil society was a little bit divided. You talk about herding cats elsewhere, civil society is the worst herd of cats you ever saw. So there were differences of opinion about the document. And the final signpost is we really do have to recognize where the worst dangers are. And I've started to say this, and actually I get more agreement than I had expected. Governments can really break the Internet. Companies, not so much. Because companies have this problem of competition. We have lots of levers against competition. Governments, especially big ones who control access to lots of people, can really impose barriers that become permanent and troubling. So we have to know where the bad guys really are, the worst potential threats are, and respond to them. And obviously, over the course of the year, we have to make multi-stakeholderism work. We're going to have the opportunity with the global governance. We may have an opportunity with domestic privacy policy to actually demonstrate the model. Because I know that command and control regulation doesn't work. But if I don't develop a meaningful alternative that I can point my friends in civil society to, they're going to go back to command and control, and you don't want to always assume that people might not actually drive us back there, which is what the concern about the ITU is.
So, Kathy, Bob, answer Mark's last point. Mark is saying he's ready to buy this model. It may be the best model even, but what evidence do we have that it is working and that it can work going forward? What are we going to talk about when we come back here in another year and say, look, it's working?
You know, I agree with Mark that we've got to figure out, now we had this conversation with Phil Weiser, so what is multi-stakeholderism? How do we make it work? How do we decide? We sat down and talked about it, but I've seen the process, and where I saw it best was actually in Paris, because Danny was in the room with civil society, the representatives of civil society, for seemed like hours or days. And there was...
They're very attractive, too, just for the record.
All folks, by the way, who had a legitimate stake and who wanted to have that reflected in the document. And there became a point in a consensus-building thing where some words were in, some words were out. Here's what I saw, though. And, you know, there's been a lot of years where I've seen these things break down horribly in bad feelings. It didn't happen. Now, everyone did not sign on, but what I saw was a process where there was continual conversation between, by the way, folks who had a different stake. So, for instance, there were some things that Verizon had concerns about, that someone from civil society had concerns about. The dialogue was being brokered beautifully by Danny at this point. By the way, I do think people matter. It was being brokered in a way that a conversation could continue. I believe that notwithstanding there were folks who walked away from this document, including ourselves, frankly, that had some issues with various pieces of sentences and pieces of paragraphs. You know, you do this for a living. This is word by word, right? That there was this this sort of moment of directionally we're going to work together. That seems to me at least a metric that we can start to look at as to whether the whatever the process is actually working. I think if the whole thing blows apart and everything goes back to their corners, we don't have it down at all. Now, can you somehow put a structure on that with rules around it and all? It destroys the process itself. And on the other hand, there's some conventions, right, to how people can exchange ideas and come to consensus. I don't really have it down yet, but I know Mark is right that if we can't make this piece of it work, then we're vulnerable to someone saying, I got it, you know, dictatorship actually doesn't work bad. You will do 1, 2, and 3, you know, and we will enforce that. So it is really a challenge for us to figure out how to reach the right balance and then to move forward.
Bob, how are we going to know when it's succeeding?
Well, let me first get to the question of multi-stakeholder initiatives and multi-stakeholder success. Multi-stakeholder, by the way, is a word that I cannot say quickly and I do not like. I wish someone would come up with another way of saying it, but thus far I have failed miraculously in doing
Several
so.
Reporters have actually told me that their editors have prohibited them from using the term in print.
Right.
So.
Great. I think that multi-stakeholder initiatives and multi-stakeholder action will succeed because we have no other choice. When it comes to the Internet, there are users, that's who Mark represents, there are companies who build it, and there are governments who have to have something to do with it. It varies according to, you know, the country and the service and the user's preference and all of those different things, fine. But there's no other solution to it. I don't see another solution to it. And I think that the countries that are now asserting what you could call cyber autocracy or trying to control the Internet will ultimately fail to do so. I think they'll fail not only because of their need to advance economically and the need for the free flow of information so that companies that don't that aren't based in those countries can do business in those countries in the repressive regimes. I think that's a very important element of it. I think it's important because there are people inside of those countries who are learning how to jump the walls. You know, I don't care which tool you use to jump the wall, siphon, Tor, you name it. You can learn how to do it. So I think that, that ultimately places like Cuba, North Korea, Burma, China, I think is already showing cracks in this and has for a while, will not succeed in keeping the Internet under a single governmental control. I just don't think that's the future. So multi-stakeholder, the multi-stakeholder approach is the right approach.
Thank
How
you.
Will we know if the yep. OECD principles are succeeding to change,
yep.
To go to your question, by more people adopting them and not saying, I support the OECD principles, but by simply talking the way they talk, by saying the free flow of information is important, by following the rules that they are setting out, by embracing the framework. And as I said at the beginning, look, no framework is perfect. It will never be, certainly not one written in a room with, you know, 30-plus people representing 30 different cultures and governments. But this is really good. And so we'd be idiots to toss it out and try something again, try something new.
All right. Thank you. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go, in the spirit of multi-stakeholderism, to questions from the floor. I'm going to ask Ambassador Kornbluh to come up here. I'm going to stand over there. While everyone's reorganizing, why don't we let Mark
I was going to give the answer to the first question no matter what. So the measure of success of this process is legitimacy and effectiveness. It's a political outcome. Do people believe that you did the right thing and it works? How do we achieve legitimacy and effectiveness? Transparency, accountability, inclusiveness, dissent, and compliance. Enforcement is not what this is about. It's compliance. We want, if every time we have to enforce a rule, we have failed. We want people to comply with rules they think were developed in a process and work to the general good. That's the outcome that we will know.
Can you repeat that list that you just gave?
Yeah, because we're going to write it.
Transparency. I have a 40-page paper.
I'm sure you do.
Transparency.
That's why I want the five words.
Transparency, accountability, inclusiveness, dissent. Big problem with the European process when some people were not allowed to dissent. And effectiveness, measured by compliance, not enforcement.
Thank you. So we're going to go to questions. We have one up front. We have two up front. We have those with microphones. Here we go. Why don't we start right here? And if you'd identify yourself, please, should maybe stand up so people can see you and indicate who you're directing your question to, if anyone in particular.
Hi, Eliza Krigman with Politico. Thanks for doing this awesome event. So my question is to the entire panel, and it's regarding the countries that would like to see a more formal international governance model. To what extent do you think this is because they feel that the U.S. has a disproportionate control over the multi-stakeholder process, and what can be done to ameliorate those concerns?
I mean, that's the essence of my mild criticism of the process, is that over the last decade, there have been pressures as the number of people and other nations that are deeply affected increases. We have not succeeded in making them feel as though they are a part of the process. Now, if they embrace these principles, then they ought to be willing to participate in the process as opposed to break them. And that's, to me, that's why I emphasize those, the core principles, is that Do they embrace the notion of decentralized open communications? Do they really embrace the notion of multi-stakeholderism? Some of the people who yell loudest about not being represented don't let a whole lot of their own folks get represented. And I've been told to reach past the governments into civil society. So that's the point here, is that if we can agree on these high-level principles and put them out as a barrier, then we can bring more of those people in.
I would agree that the complexity that Mark just put his finger on is that the government may or may not agree to change the way it does business, it governs its own people. There's, in many countries, a very different energy with the people themselves. So that folks who are on the net tend to be, at least my experience, tend to naturally think this is an open user community, and thus why wouldn't they be able to do this in an open user way. For countries where there are still not a lot of folks on the net, by the way, starting to decrease a lot because of mobile broadband, there's still a split with what is this thing doing and how is it affecting other parts of my economy. So in part, I think this is an involvement engagement issue. In part, it's a government-to-government dialogue. And in part, it's a maturation, get the stuff out there. Because once folks, our experience is once the people have access to these technologies, a lot of this energy just follows.
I just wanted to say one thing on this point, which is that, you know, Bob joked about the term multi-stakeholderism, but that kind of gets to part of the problem, which is that multi-stakeholder can seem to mean specific organizations, even people, that have been working on this issue. And I think the service that's been provided by NTIA talking more about what multi-stakeholderism means and the importance of it, and other discussions that have been going on about what is it apart from certain individuals, certain entities, and what makes it function well, can start to address your issue. I'd like to make a proposal, Daryl. Maybe Brookings wants to host some kind of contest to rename multi-stakeholderism to make it a more accessible concept so that,
only
you know.
We can do this in
Well, the literature has a well-defined concept of participatory governance. And maybe that's more friendly to what we want to accomplish. But the literature has this concept in it. And that multi-stakeholderism, yes, it doesn't roll off your tongue, nor does participatory governance.
Do you have a mic? Go ahead, Jim.
Jim Snyder from iSolon and Harvard Software Center for Ethics. First of all, I'd like to applaud the ambassador for your goals. I think they're great. My question concerns with the credibility that the United States has as a country to pursue those goals. So Robert maybe touched on it, your comments on SOPA and the Italian democracy example. I don't know if that was 10. And you, Mark, when you talked about telecom regulations not being very consumer-friendly in the United States. My overall sense is telecom governance in the United States is one of the most corrupt areas of American government, where you have highly concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, a recipe for corruption, and that's the way it often plays out. Just give you one example, some of the players that are actively involved here. Since World War II, we've written a major report, close to $500 billion of spectrum rights away without public compensation. How is that done? Largely by not doing it openly and doing it in an obscure way so the public doesn't understand what's going on. And some of the major players here, like the NTIA, has been very active, and it's even accelerated during the current administration, giving away huge amounts of rights under the public radar. One of the ways they do that is not being very open, by not following the government's president's open government directive, by not following the FOIA laws and whatnot. To what extent do we need to set an example for other countries when we have these noble ideas? The Cold War, classic example, in the 1950s, you know, we preached to all these other countries but didn't have civil rights for blacks. It became, at some point, really embarrassing. How can we preach these examples when we don't practice them themselves in our own telecom governance?
Thanks.
I want to frame that in a different way, because it's interesting. Sometimes when you have a collective document like this, you go to the lowest common denominator. And sometimes you pull everybody up. And I would submit that if you look across the UNESCO document, the Council of Europe document, and this document, the document is a little bit higher, maybe a lot higher, than some of the people who have ascribed to it. So the moment here is, and Ambassador described it, as a way to show to the rest of the world, this is what we're about. But at that same moment, you turn the light inward. And you ask yourself the question, I have my pet peeves about declaring broadband eligible for universal service. Does our policy comport with this document or the SOPA or the SOPA issue? So now is a moment where you, all the civil society people around the world can take this document and show it to their government and say, wait a minute, you have to adhere to a higher standard. It works both ways, and we should do the same thing. Needless to say, my listservs are rampant about how SOPA comports and whether or not it comports in a legal manner with this document. It's a wonderful debate. I'll clip it and send you the thread if you'd like it.
Mark, in the back.
Mark McCarthy with the Software and Information Industry Association. This is a great group, and congratulations to all of you for the OECD principles. They're an excellent framework. We heartily endorse them. The question of the way forward is the question that I'd like the panel to address. And, Bob, you sort of talked a little bit about this with your reference to trade policy. I wonder to what extent trade policy is a way in which progress can be made on implementing these ideas of Internet freedom and the free flow of information. Any thoughts or reflections on how best that might be done?
Well, right away, I would suggest that the nine countries, perhaps 12, that are going to be involved in something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, take the language that has been tabled by the United States on the free flow of information and say, gee, that sounds good to us. Why don't we make that part of this trade agreement, the first, as it's known in the Obama administration, the first trade agreement of the 21st century, which I like to call the first trade agreement that reflects reality, that reflects what's really going on out there. And the fact that the National Foreign Trade Council pulled together some very significant companies, Google, Microsoft, GE, Citi, and many others, and you can go on to nftc.org and look at the principles that we put forward. The fact that they were able to bring us all together around these ideas that information must flow freely, don't try to say that quickly, flow freely across national boundaries is incredibly important for the future of internal economies and the global economy. It's really important also in terms of fighting economic inequality in the world writ large, I believe, because it will give people in other countries the chance that, that small companies, medium-sized companies now have in this country due to the Internet to be able to export more, to be able to be found elsewhere, to go outside the town or the county and to go to another country to sell their wares. So I believe that trade is a really important path moving forward. The TPP happens to be the focus right now of the U.S. Trade Representative's office, and I would hope that it would continue to be so as you know, we see whether Canada, Mexico, and Japan also get involved in those negotiations.
Thanks. Daniel Brenner with Hogan Lovells, and I also teach at Georgetown Law School, of course, on the Internet. Nice to see you again, Ambassador. My question's informed by this book I'm reading, which came out last year called The Net Delusion, which I think is a useful book for anybody who's overly exuberant about the Internet from time to time. And it really goes to your comment, Bob, because I totally agree with Kathy. This document and the work you've done, Karen, is so important. It's directionally right, and you know we're on the right track with this. But then I think about China and your point about no economic economics will force countries that suppress the Internet to they'll lose if they do. And, you know, China is not losing. They're winning economically. And yet China has this does engage in many of the things that are so contrary to the work that the OECD and the other groups have done. So, again, in a somewhat pessimistic mood, Bob, does China prove the point that no matter how hard we try with coming up with the right answers, and even if we could get free press and the carriers to be part of a civil society debate and where everybody agrees, which is a slight challenge in this country, that how do we get around that? You're not going to be able to easily prove that it's going to destroy you economically if you don't adopt these forward-looking principles.
Right.
I studied Chinese history, went to China first in 1979, I've been there a lot, which means that I'm like everybody else, I know absolutely nothing about China. You know, there's the famous quote that is attributed alternatively to a conversation between Henry Kissinger and Zhou Enlai, or one between André Malraux and Zhou Enlai, where they're sitting and they're discussing the history of revolutions, and Kissinger Malraux says to, is going on and on about the French Revolution, and turns to Zhou Enlai and he says, and what do you think about the impact of the French Revolution on the modern world? And Zhou Enlai looks at him in the 1970s and says, it is too early to tell. So that would be my general response about China. I would say this. China is a unique place with a wonderful entrepreneurial people. They are developing magnificent things. It is also a place where I believe, and this is a personal belief, not a statement from my company, where I believe that the current system of one-party rule cannot last forever. How long it takes for social, economic, cultural things to change, and for the change to reach the top, nobody knows. But I think that the way that they deal with the outside world, and the internet is now very much a part of that outside world, will be both a reflection and a symptom of changes inside that country. That's a very easy way for me to say I can't comment on it, but it is a real enigma about the current Chinese situation and what it proves.
Dan, I want to turn this on you because it's interesting. What you said about their attitude about they're not losing, up until 15 years ago, they would have said that about their communist system. They firmly believed that they were not losing, that they inevitably would win, and of course, they've scrapped it. And so the real question, and then the fundamental question of once you introduce this type of freedom, can you suppress it? As Kathy pointed out, there's a lot of governments around the world that learned that this, you can't suppress it. So the answer is that they may be doing well today, but as this technology has only begun to penetrate, this is the quarter-life crisis of the digital revolution. We have at least another 75 years to go. We haven't seen anything yet. And the willingness to suppress the innovation and adoption over the next 75 years will actually render you a backwater because we've only just begun.
I will say one more thing on this. There is a comparison to be drawn between the 1950s when China was importing Soviet equipment that was quote-unquote turnkey. So they would bring in a factory or a plant and you could turn the key, and then they discovered 5-6 years later that they didn't have the equipment or the know-how to fix it. Well, now we have what's called indigenous innovation, which could be described in less attractive terms. Will indigenous innovation put the Chinese in certain areas in exactly the same position that they were in the late 50s? And if certain companies and certain things happen, will the Chinese be left holding something they don't know how to fix, or they can't advance further? Big question.
Can I just add one thing, which is it's a really, really interesting question. But I just want to make clear that we're not sitting around hoping. You know, the president put out this cyber security agenda. The Secretary Clinton has given some amazing speeches, which I really commend to everybody, on internet freedom. And, you know, one of the things that Danny and I talked about at the very beginning of the OECD process when he was thinking, you know, do we want the U.S. government, how involved do we want the U.S. government in this process? Is this a good place to have this discussion? One of the issues was this is a place where countries like China have a dialogue, but they don't have a veto. So we're going to try to pull them in, but we can articulate what it is that a bunch of like-minded countries think about how to approach the Internet, try to build global consensus. And I think, just from the various issues that I've seen that have gotten a global consensus on, something like anti-bribery that the OECD works on, it really does make a difference. How much of a difference? You know, I think time will tell. But it does make a difference when the global community comes together and says, you know, that's really not how we do things. And so I'm hoping that we can use these in that way.
And Dan, I would just add a little editorial gloss. The really interesting thing about the OECD is it's a soft law organization. It certainly is a place where ideas develop that may evolve into binding international legal instruments, as you know, in trade areas or others, or some of the anti-corruption work. But you know, the OECD starts off as a set of recommendations by design. You know, what's really interesting about that is that at the World Wide Web Consortium, where I spent a lot of time, the group that develops the technical standards for the web, the web consortium calls the documents that describe how the web is supposed to work recommendations. And this is it's a very perplexing thing about the Internet environment. It's voluntary. No one has to do it. And actually, people can do it wrong. There's no, you know, there's no exile in any kind of formal top-down sense. But what I think we've learned from the Internet technical community is that when you put out clear recommendations about how to be part of the Internet, eventually people say, oh yeah, we actually need to be part of that. We need to be part of it technically. You know, some country could say, well, you may not use the TCP/IP protocol. You may not use HTML. In fact, some very large countries for quite a while refused to recognize the Internet technical standards because they didn't go through the formal technical standard setting bodies, the ITU or the ISO. And, you know, everyone said, well, fine, don't use the web if you don't want to. And, you know, most of them, as far as I can tell, all of them, have decided that actually it's a good idea to use those voluntary recommendations as a way forward. And I think that we'll see the same kind of thing in the end. Maybe it's too soon to tell. but in the end, I think the power of soft law here, where you're dealing with a networked environment and an interconnected world, is incredibly powerful. Over here.
I'd like to expound upon something that two gentlemen spoke about with regard to the Cold War in the 50s and also the trade delegation situation. My name is Ed Hines. I represent Ed Hines and Associates. I am also related to the oldest African-American family in the United States, the Kwandos, as descended from the Amquando family of the Fanti tribe in Ghana, who were first freed here in 1864. I also want to expound what the gentleman said about the Cold War and America forwarding its policies to foreign countries and yet people looking at what was going on at home. I'd like to expound or relate back to a situation that Adam Clayton Powell did with President Eisenhower. He said, instead of sending all of these other things over there that you're sending, why not send a piece of Americana? And thus came the concept of the jazz ambassadors. And they went into places where the communist rule was quite prevalent, and they sort of changed the whole concept of things around. I, myself in particular, work with the Temptations. And we're working on a similar concept, the Temptations Ambassadors of Music and Goodwill, to take them into various countries overseas. And I don't know how many of you may know, but the Temptations song Get Ready was used as a commercial by Comcast, the largest telecommunications company in the U.S., and the FCC to alert everyone to change from analog to digital. In 2009. The song Get Ready was also used last year. Power was also used last year in a BlackBerry commercial. So I want to speak with each one of you distinguished panel members afterwards and find out ways that we can use the concept that we're doing now to take the Temptations overseas, particularly in places like Africa and the Middle East.
I had the former chairman of the Nigerian Stock Exchange, Professor Herbert Orji, in our home on Sunday, and he has forwarded our material to various people in the Nigerian government. We attended the birthday party for President Zuma, and we had two independent Chinese television producers in our home on Sunday. So I most definitely want to speak with all of you, find a way that we can get the things that we're trying to do within the Internet community.
I hear, get ready for the Internet.
It was getting ready for Comcast.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Going from the lofty to the mundane here. Hello, everyone. Ambassador, welcome back home for a few days. My name is Judy Harris. I represent the American, the Association of National Advertisers and the Credo Coalition. I actually came by here today only to say hello to the ambassador, which I didn't get to do because I was going to be headed over to the National Press Club, where there is a concurrent meeting going on with chairman of the with the CEO of ICANN, Ron Beckstrom, and Steve Crocker, who is the chairman of the ICANN board. I didn't think we were going to be touching on the subject of top-level domains today. But Administrator Strickling did bring it up, and I feel that it's incumbent on everybody. It's incumbent on me to respond to that. The word accountability was raised, I think, maybe by you, Mark, in terms of the multi-stakeholder process, the free Internet. I want to make it clear that I personally and the coalition I represent totally ascribe to those principles. We don't want to do anything ever to harm those principles. But Mr. Beckstrom also made a public presentation yesterday, and in that presentation he said that the process was only as good as the faith that everybody had in ICANN. And I know Politico has already sent out an article here. I don't know if I can find it, posted on their whiteboard, quoting Administrator Strickling, saying that when parties ask us to overturn the outcomes of these processes, they are providing ammunition to other governments that would like to take control of the Internet. And Strickling said, citing opposition some had to ICANN's top-level domain name expansion. Story coming. I hope I get interviewed for that story. But in any event, isn't the truth of the matter that if entities do not believe that ICANN is accountable to its stakeholders in some way, that more than anything else will give these other countries that we're concerned about an opportunity or an excuse to move in? And specifically, I'd like to ask the panelists, is ICANN currently accountable to anyone should they not follow the will of their multi-stakeholders, or are they free to unilaterally reject everything? And I think I'd like the panelists, maybe Ambassador Kornbluh, to comment in particular on the letter that the OECD signed along with the United Nations and about 34 other IGOs raising concerns about some of the ICANN processes.
Thank you. Who'd like to start?
Well, look, consensus is not unanimity, and legitimacy is an art, not a science. And so and believe me, civil society is as difficult to have consensus or unanimity as you can imagine. So the questioning of the legitimacy of the process is absolutely vital, and that's why I emphasize that. We're going to have some multi-stakeholder processes here, and the stakeholders should define their own rules of governance. And in the end, there will be stakeholders who disagree, and that's why we want the right of dissent. And in a lot of these documents, you don't have the right of dissent. We want dissent published along with consensus. But at the end of the day, all you can do is ask the question, do people believe this is legitimate? And there will be some who say not and some who say yes. And if the people who say not significantly outnumber the people who say yes, then the institution is no longer legitimate. And it needs to reform. And I agree with you that the existing institutions have not used the last 10 years with this dramatic increase in stakeholders globally to embrace those people so that now they're looking for potentially other institutions, and I think that would be a bad thing. But you're absolutely right. I cannot tell you whether in any scientific way they fully represented every stakeholder, or should they represent every stakeholder. They can only do the best they can.
Bob?
I would compliment you on a terrific question with a no-win answer. I think part of the problem here, and this is all I'll say, is the origins of ICANN. And nobody can turn back time. And because of the way that it originated and its composition and physically where it was located, it seems to me that as the Internet grew, this was bound to grow into a dilemma and a question that people were going to ask. You know, they're just the way it is. Sorry.
Let me just say one word. Seems to me that Larry was trying to separate the issue from the process. Judy, you've raised issues that any number of stakeholders are concerned about. I think that the Stickling letter was a very good and strong articulation of a number of very important issues that need and should be addressed. I have not seen the letter today that Larry referenced, but I think this back and forth and the resolution of this is in fact a part of the multi-stakeholder process, which always feels very messy in the middle. And at this point, I think we want to drive it as hard as we can, all of us, to get to a place where we think we're going to have the kind of stability and legitimacy that everybody is looking for here. So I appreciate, I think, what Mark just said, that there's going to be some dissent here. And let's see how the process works through. And I actually applaud Larry for articulating what the issues are at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it to NTAA to talk to the issues themselves in question. But as an outsider to the process looking in, one of the things that I've been so impressed by is, and this was mentioned earlier, if we have no alternative to multi-stakeholderism, then we have to make it work. And that's what I've seen NTIA trying to do, is make the process work, and working long and hard with ICANN to try to make it more representative and make it function better. And so I think we have to just be really careful that as we have the dialogue, we have it in a context of there's no alternative to a multi-stakeholder process, and let's make it work.
One more question. We'll have one more. Go ahead. John Piha.
Thank you. I forget my name sometimes. Thanks, Danny. John Piha, Carnegie Mellon University. What is the biggest threat to this new process? Is it institutions and policies from the telephone world reasserting themselves somehow? Is it something within the process itself that you see as a risk? What should be what we be watching out for over the coming year?
You've heard a lot about the potential for a different set of institutions that have methods and approaches that are not going to work very well. And I believe that is a serious problem. The running code, rough consensus approach has worked well. It is well suited to this dynamic space. So now I get great differences of opinion across people about how real that threat is. But there is this signal moment at the end of the year where a decision may be made to radically change the institutions. We better take that seriously.
Any other comments, response to that question?
Look, I think the biggest threat is that we're not paying attention. I think there's a fairly strong consensus on how this ought to go forward. But if we don't pay attention, there's always another view. And so, in part, I again thank Daryl for having this forum, because we need to understand that just because we believe that directionally things are right doesn't mean everybody does, and that we have a burden on ourselves to persuade others that this is the right way for the right reasons, not just for us, but for others as well.
I just want to say something that's tangentially related, which is when we first started having these conversations, you were at the Commerce Department working on privacy and trying to step back from that process and think, okay, what's the process by which we're going through as an administration to deal with some of these internet issues? And one of the nice things about these principles is it's been a way of, we've gone international in articulating them before we were articulating them domestically, but the idea was to say, how can we explain to the world how we're dealing with this, these messy issues of the I can't remember how you termed it.
Maturation
challenges with the underlying internet. And I think, you know, it's been that give and take between working on the specific issue and trying to articulate it more broadly has been really rich. And I think going forward, it'll be really rich for our country, but for other countries in terms of figuring out how they deal with, you know, how do they go about dealing with these maturation issues. I don't think Danny's gotten enough credit in this whole discussion for the leadership that he showed and exhibited on these principles, not only for being part of thinking them through in the first place and doing a lot of the drafting, but doing the incredible negotiating that I think this is a key part of these processes. Kathy said the people matter. The trust that was built up in the conversations among the countries with Danny on the phone, going in the detail, and the discussions with civil society and the business groups into the wee hours of the night, I think we just established a ton of goodwill just in getting these adopted, and I think Danny deserves an enormous amount of credit, and so I think he deserves a round of applause.
I don't know. No, but, you know, the great thing, I think that the reason we got where we got is, aside from some of the great people here and in this room, is actually people in the internet world know how to do this. We see this transition from a community that's just been about, you know, hooking a bunch of computers together, not an easy task, but a kind of confined technical task, to some of those same people bringing the same skills and the same ethos of collaboration and cooperation, rough consensus, running code, to policy questions. And I think that's it's an incredibly exciting time, really, because I think that if these principles have done one thing, it's created the opportunity for a lot of those people to get involved and to make it work out. These principles could, in the end, come to absolutely nothing, except, you know, a couple of nice events here and, you know, whatnot. But I think what will make a difference is, I think all the panelists have said this in one way or the other, is people recognizing that there's a set of ideas to gather around, that there's a way that we can all make progress together, and that's everyone from you know, those who have been those who were the Vint Cerfs of the world, who were there, you know, with the first messages that sent back and forth, to the entrepreneurs in the developing countries that are looking and saying, how do we get involved in this environment. I would just close by saying I really think that this process, this multi-stakeholder process, the process that the internet community has pioneered in many ways, I think works based on the fact that people have things they need to do together. It doesn't really work when one person tells someone else what to do. That's kind of the Marx command and control model. What works about the internet model is when people realize they have common things they need to get done. I think that the trade issues that we're looking at, whether it's with the TPP or discussions that we're having with the European Commission about consumer privacy or any number of other issues, these are issues where we as a global community all have to be able to work together. We have to have a set of rules that we can operate under. And I think it's those cases where, as everyone has said, if we've agreed on one thing, it's that we don't actually have any other model. We might like to think we do. People who want, you know, to build larger buildings in Geneva or fill existing ones, you know, might like to do something else for those reasons.
But it's very clear that this is the one method that we have, the one organizing principle we have to solve the problems that we have in the internet environment. There will be some countries that often make that flip. There will be in the internet world, there will be some countries that will decide they're not sure how engaged they want to be. And I think those are always kind of the trick questions about the multi-stakeholder process. Well, how are you going to get so-and-so involved? And why would so-and-so be involved? And not to make light of any of those questions, I don't think that's where we should actually be focusing our attention. I think where our attention belongs is on actually building the global interoperability mechanisms, whether it's for the free flow of information within the trade context, whether it's for fundamental human rights in the online environment, whether it's for privacy in the online environment. These are things that we have to work out. They are right in front of us, and over the next couple of years, we'll either do it well or not so well. And that will be, I think, the test of how well these principles are working. So I think I'm going to turn it back to Daryl, and thank you all for staying here for a relatively abstract but I hope quite engaging discussion. And thanks again to Daryl for
great discussion. We appreciate all of you coming out. I want to thank Danny, Karen, Mark, Kathy, and Bob, and Larry, who had to take off. So thank you again for joining us.